Hello, I'm Matt Wells, this is Media Talk, and coming up this week, ITV prepares for the future as Archie Norman is finally named as the channel's new chairman. Also in the podcast,
we have seen what the culture of free has done to the music business, and we believe that we cannot, as a business or as a society, allow that to happen to news.
Times editor James Harding outlines his grand plan to rewrite the economics of online. Plus, squabbles at the PCC and the BBC, and...
There will be down the lines. Actually, there are quite a lot down the lines that either come from around England or indeed down the lines of Millbank or down the lines of Broadcasting House when we're in West London. There is quite a lot of that. It's looking at what the editorial reasons are for those, what the right way is of doing them, and when the right points are to do them.
Five Live controller Adrian Van Claveren comes clean on the practicalities of the station's move to Salford. All this and lots more on Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, there's heaps to get through this week, so let's quickly say hello to our panel, Media Guardian editor Jane Martinson and KidsCo TV managing director Paul Robinson. Paul, where have you been since you were last here?
Modest, gallivanting last time.
Yeah, modest little trip. A week in Hong Kong, right. 4 days in Australia in Sydney, and then 3 days in Auckland, which is a country that goes to sleep at 6 o'clock at night.
This is New Zealand, yes.
New Zealand, yeah, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so KidsCo TV expanding around the world. Excellent. Jane, now...
Jane to her desk at King's Place.
Sorry.
I was going to say, you're something of a lucky charm to the Media Guardian podcast and to ailing broadcasters, because when you were here a fortnight ago, Lord Burns turned up at Channel 4, and now this week...
Someone else to talk about. How
ITV,
exciting.
Archie Norman. Yes, very exciting.
I time it like this, which is, of course, why we got the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, it's the first ITV cock-a-hoop at the thought that this didn't leak. For the first time ever,
I know.
Shenanigans with ITV's executive team and non-executive team didn't leak anywhere.
Well, this is because they shop at Sainsbury's, probably.
Well, no, Asda, so it should have been. No, this is the
That's
story.
The point. They're not shopping at Asda.
No, quite. I see what you mean, yes. This is the story that former Tory MP and former Asda chairman Archie Norman has been named as the new chairman of ITV to succeed Michael Grade. Jane, I mean, do you know much about him? What should we make about of this point?
I mean, the share price reaction up 3% in a day shows that he has got what the shareholders of ITV are desperate for, which is a huge experience at restructuring companies. And as we all know, ITV has been in need of a bit of a transformation, I think is the former McKinsey as well, started his career at McKinsey.
Management consultant.
Indeed. Mm. And so that's he's been given a big vote of confidence from the shareholders, who are feeling pretty battered from the past 5 years. Mm. Because he's seen as someone who can actually, well, maybe even break a bit off or sell it off, or, you know, he's very much a sort of corporate restructuring man. Mm. And he's got a very good reputation for that. He has absolutely no media experience at all. But given the sort of success Michael Grade has had, and who was obviously steeped in
media
experience.
An ITV tanked under on his watch, yes. No.
So nobody seems to be sort of finding that a great disadvantage.
Does it matter, Paul, that the chair, he's the non-executive chairman, isn't he?
Well, I think it's actually a very smart move to have a non-exec who comes from outside the industry. You can have a real objective overview, not steeped by broadcasting, you know, not sort of got any baggage that goes with it, and he can take a truly, you know, objective and fresh view. As Jane says, critical now is who he hires as the chief executive. Yeah. And I'd have thought that having got him in place, they now must have somebody who's got broadcasting experience. There's obviously a huge amount of comment about this. There's one lovely one I really thought which was great, which was Charles Allen was a caterer, now ITV's hired a grocer. It doesn't really matter after the Tony Ball shambles.
I like the TV repairman from Asda.
The TV repairman from Asda. I mean, you know, I think also ITV must be relieved to at least hired somebody.
Yes.
Because having gone on for so long with, you know, complete shambles, really, and the whole Tony Ball thing, at least they've now got one guy sort of rooted as being, you know, the chairman. And critical.
A big hitter. I mean, James Crosby's been really criticised for his handling of this nominations committee, but this is someone who genuinely has a name. And actually, I think the really interesting thing, although I'm slightly obsessed by politics in the media at the moment, is his Tory background. Yeah. Both Burns worked for every Tory chancellor under the sort of pre-97, and now we have a chairman of ITV. Obviously, even more steeped in Tory politics, was a Tory MP, great friends of William Hague, you know, hugely influential shadow cabinet minister. Those links, although he downplayed it in comments yesterday to the press, well, he didn't downplay it, but he said he had obviously contacts on both sides of the house. Mm. I mean, I just think that's hugely, hugely influential in today's environment with a sort of, yeah, we're looking towards perhaps a new administration.
No, I agree. And also, I think it's also about being commercial, isn't it? I mean, the Tories believe in the market. They believe in the market actually supporting things. And that's what ITV has to do. I mean, ITV has got to be a commercial broadcaster that washes its face and finds a clear place in the market. And, you know, he talks in the quotes about in his appointment about ITV looking very different in 5 to 10 years' time. That's absolutely right. He's got to find a commercial solution to make ITV sustainable, you know, going forward for the long term.
Yeah, and we mentioned just briefly the chief executive appointment. He needs to get on with that quickly. And I mean, he could either persuade John Cresswell to stay. John Cresswell, a very competent chief executive.
He's actually pretty popular internally.
Yeah. Or if John Cresswell really does want to go, then get Peter Fincham to do it. It shouldn't be that difficult, should it? One of the two of them.
Yeah. And I mean, they have, because of his non-media background, you know, there is a suggestion that he would go for someone who has a real sort of creative tint, which obviously Peter Fincham does. I mean, but Iverman, I mean, the internal candidate, weirdly, for the appointment of sort of a strong non-executive chairman, the internal candidates no longer seem quite as weak. Although, remember that the shareholders had, they were seen as non-starters for a long time because of Michael Grade. They're seen as Michael Grade's appointments, although that's not fair with John Cresswell, but, you know, that they were never going to progress because of being tarred with the sort of former administration.
Yeah, I mean, if John Cresswell and Peter Fincham were outside ITV, you'd say they were extremely strong candidates. The fact they're inside, somehow they're tainted and not seen as being as strong. But of course, they're both highly competent executives, and I think both could do a great job. And with Peter Fincham, I guess the issue is, you know, to what extent do you want to lean towards a creative, and to what extent do you want to lean towards a CEO who's going to fundamentally restructure the business, because that's what it also needs.
Yeah, absolutely. He could do with restructuring the board as well, couldn't he? Yeah. A bunch of useless useless what's-its, aren't they? I mean, they're just,
I think that's fair.
Is it difficult for somebody who comes in appointed by that board to then turn around to half of them and say,
if you're the chairman appointed by shareholders?
Right.
I mean, he's obviously got the backing of those big shareholders. He's the chairman of that board. If there's anyone who can do it, it's him. And, you know, that the board has been criticised. They've made a few cosmetic changes, haven't they? But it really doesn't seem to operate. Actually, there's something about media boards. I mean, look at Channel 4. They, you know, dysfunctionality seems to be actually part of their DNA. Yeah.
And it's sort of understandable with Channel 4 because of the public service broadcasting. Therefore, you've got to put some great and good on there. But with ITV, it should be a ruthless commercial machine. Archie is ruthless. Archie is really focused. He'll sort that out.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
On to the press now. And James Harding, specifically, the editor of The Times. He's been talking in more detail about how he's going to implement Rupert Murdoch's edict to turn the freeloading tide back. He was speaking at the Society of Editors conference in the suitably salubrious setting of Stansted in Essex. Now, The Times editors, he pledged to, quote, rewrite the economics of newspapers. Good luck to him on that one. Here's a chunky bit of his speech.
The media in 2020 is going to be defined by nothing quite so much, clearly, as by what we do now. And it seems as though we, as an industry, and certainly my newspaper and the newspaper company that I work for, feels as though we're engaged in a revolution. We are now going to rewrite the economics of the newspaper and news gathering and delivery business. And we have to do that because, as this conference so wisely realises, we are in the fight of our lives. It seems to me that in the two centuries since John Walter launched that paper, the real issue has been this extraordinary divorce of value and price. These days, you can buy a tall Americano from Starbucks for double the price of The Times, and The Times, of course, will give you more than 120 years' worth of experience of political reporting. It will give you the largest foreign network of correspondents of any broadsheet, including dedicated bureaus in Baghdad and Kabul. We have correspondents covering the ocean, electronic games, and, of course, one on bird watching. And we do that at an incredibly reasonable cost. Journalism costs. It is not for free. We ran a bureau in Baghdad throughout the war. We calculate that cost us just over £1.5 million for the course of the Iraq war. That is what our readers want, that we live in an age that is not dumbing down, but dumbing up. I'm always enormously encouraged by the fact that last year the British Museum overtook the Blackpool Pier as Britain's favourite tourist attraction. So we believe we have a product of great value, and we believe that there is a market for it. So once you have made that that clear calculation, what remains to us to do is to put independent journalism on an economically sustainable footing. And to do that, we're taking three steps. Firstly, as you may know, we are going to take on the culture of free. What this means is that we have seen what the culture of free has done to the music business, and we believe that we cannot, as a business or as a society, allow that to happen to news. So from the spring of next year, we will start charging for the digital editions of The Times. We're still working on the exact pricing model, but my expectation is that we will charge you for the day's paper, i.e. for a 24-hour sign-up to The Times online, and we will also establish a subscription price as well. In the same spirit, we are ending the practice of giving away the paper. We're cancelling all our bulks, and we think that it's good for us and good for the business to stop indulging in the trickery and fakery of the ABCs. So we want to be focused on real sales to real customers, and incidentally, that's what our advertisers want too. The second thing is we're going to confront those people who we think represent a serious threat to the future of independent journalism, which is helps explain the reason why we've had some, you know, quite frank conversations with Google and the BBC. And three, we're going to take care of our customers. Historically, the newspaper business has been terrific at treating its best customers worst and its worst customers best. We give the paper away to people who could care less, and we pay little or no attention to those people who love it and pay for it every day. So we want to make sure we can deliver it to you at home in your pajamas. We want to make sure that we establish a rewards program, viz., you know, Times Plus. We want to make sure that we take care of those people who really believe and pay for our journalism.
James Harding, the editor of The Times, and I've just had a vision of James Harding in his pyjamas, which is slightly worrying. Now, Jane, listen, everything that he says, it's very difficult to disagree with the sentiments behind them, that he wants to support independent journalism, that he wants to concentrate on real sales to real customers, that he wants to treat his best customers better. But I just don't see how this is going to happen. But it does, at least, it sounds like a plan, doesn't it? It sounds coherent.
Well, I think listening to him, it was a very eloquent speech, actually. It was very well delivered and well thought out. You know, we were just saying that point about Starbucks. It does encapsulate the sense that, you know, you pay twice as much for an Americano as you do for something with all that information
he
and all that work behind it. It's incredibly convincing. But, you know, as the blogosphere has gone wild sort of pulling apart his speech, one of the problems with saying we're going to rewrite the economics is that the web and Google have already done that for us to our disservice. I mean, well, there's an argument to be made, but obviously in a way that has dramatically reduced the revenues that newspaper groups are getting. So it's quite hard to see how that's going to work. On the other hand, you know, you don't know how he's going to do it, but I think really interesting, somebody sent a comment in online which said, this is madness that we're writing this off. How can any of us say what's going to happen with something that's only been in existence for 10 years? And I think that's the point. I think actually there's nobody in the industry that's sort of willing it to fail. I think everybody is waiting to see if it will work. Yeah. And that's the difference.
I think
but
you're
absolutely
right.
Few of us are going to actually follow suit because few of us can actually work out how on earth it's going to happen.
Well, it's quite, I suppose, Paul, it's quite easy in a way for them to do this because The Times is not the leading player online. They're quite far, far behind their competitors. In a sense, they've not really got anything to lose by doing this and a great deal to gain. If he can rewrite the economics of newspapers, that's a pretty good achievement for Harding.
Well, it's an achievement for Harding, and his name goes down in history, clearly, you know, as a sort of an innovator, and my goodness me, you know, the impact will be huge. But I think back to Jane's point, I think she's absolutely right. I mean, the issue here is everyone wants this to happen, but there are some very big challenges here. You know, The culture of the internet is a culture of free. And you've got to persuade people now to change that mindset and start paying for something. And, you know, as soon as you give something away free, you have a completely different view about something to if you pay for it. You know, think about, you know, paid and free newspapers. Could the standard, London Evening Standard, ever go back to being a paid-for newspaper, having gone the way it's gone? There's no way back. It's a one-way street. So I think they've got to really somehow convince people that there's value here and to pay for it online. Now, if you can try and get people to understand and think in their mindset that this is like a physical purchase of the goods, like buying the paper in the newsagent, then you know you'll win. But it's not. You know, people actually expect now stuff on the internet to be free. And he's right, of course. You know, whether it's music or it's journalism, someone's invested in that. There's IP in that. There's value in that. You shouldn't expect to get it for free. But people do.
One of the interesting things about News International's online operation is that Jeremy Clarkson is responsible for something ridiculous like 25% of the traffic. So you can see that there could be value for some of their online properties. It's just
and that's what they tried with the New York Times, wasn't it? With the most popular commentators in America, Maureen O'Dowd, that people that you really would expect people to pay for, and they found that actually traffic plummeted because although people love her, they weren't necessarily going to click on a payment. And I mean, micropayments. The other interesting thing we haven't mentioned is that
he ruled out micropayments.
So you couldn't do that. You couldn't say, although his 24-hour thing. I suppose you could say, okay, if you want to read Clarkson's thoughts, mad person that you are, then you have to pay for the whole day.
I think micropayments don't work. I think Jane's absolutely right. I mean, if they can somehow get some sort of subscription model going, you get to a point with your subscription, a bit like your Sky TV, really. You know, you start, you're paying quite a lot of money, and you're paying more every month. But somehow, because you pay it every month, you sort of forget about it, and you don't any more intellectualise it.
And
you don't
love film, isn't it?
Well, love film's a good example.
I'd forgotten to watch a film for 6 months and realise I was still paying.
But you're still paying for it,
and so I'd forgotten.
So if they can get subscriptions embedded, I think they might succeed. But it's going to be a tough uphill struggle.
Mm. Yeah. All right. Well, until you hear otherwise, everything at Guardian.co.uk is free. So,
Emily said that actually, the director of digital content said that
occasional podcast contributor
paywalls is a stupid idea. So she's sort of very much set against that. For
yes, absolutely.
The Guardian.
Apart from here and there, like this, we're going to do a Guardian Club as well. That's no secret. The Times Club apparently £20 a year. Apparently, it's very good. You get Back massages. I can't even say it, from Matthew Paris and everything.
You've got a thing about Times journalist today.
There's a reason for Emily turning around her strategy with a back massage during the podcast. How marvellous would that be? But maybe not Matthew Paris.
Perhaps not. Poly time being maybe.
Blushing. For those readers, those listeners that can't see Matt anything. Blush.
Matt has now gone red.
Celebrate our freedom by heading to our blog at guardian.co.uk/media talk. I'm Matt Wells. You are indeed listening to Media Talk. Let's stick with the press as we move on to our news and brief section. Jane, The Guardian and the PCC have fallen out again, haven't they? This is over the News of the World phone tapping story. Is this a storm in a teacup or a really serious issue?
No, I think there's some really serious issues afoot. And I think there's been a sort of combination of things and about what the PCC is and what it stands for and what it's meant to do. And I think the overriding issue here is one about libel reform and how everybody in newspapers are worried about the increasing use of London as the sort of libel capital of the world.
You get the sense that there is a head of steam building up behind this now.
And I think on two fronts. I think you've got the sort of the government, you've got lawyers. And of course, lawyers are never going to
vote for Christmas? Turkey.
Exactly.
That's the turkey thing.
Vote for fewer regulations. Yeah. And a sort of an industry that is really, unless it can prove that the PCC is tough enough to head off this, it's sort of, it makes the arguments so much more difficult to make. Mm. Having said that, our own fight with the PCC or the Guardian's fight with the PCC was over this specific investigation. The editor, Alan Rusbridger, has withdrawn. Although not withdrawn...
He's not suggesting that he's taken the Guardian out of the PCC.
He personally is an editor from the Code Committee.
Yeah, yeah.
No, very different from... Yeah. We're still paying
We're still paying our subs.
Yes. And we'll continue to do so. Because, the fact is, it's sort of self-regulation... is nobody's suggestion. Self-regulation is not the way forward. It's whether you can make that actually a workable self-regulation.
Yeah, all right. There's been trouble over the BBC as well, Paul Robinson, your former colleagues. Well, there's now a regular system of publication of expenses and salaries, isn't there? Now, this, I understand, because I was checking this out, is the last set of publications of expenses that were made before they knew that they were going to be published, if you see what I mean. Okay. So before
behaviour changed.
Before behaviour changed. So I think, well, this is the last of the 70p taxis. But it wasn't taxis. It was parking.
It was parking.
Mark Thompson.
You've got
the piece there.
Yeah, Mark Thompson, who has a salary, by the way, of $834,000 a year, just for sort of context, charged 70p for car parking. Now, one does think that's somewhat mean.
Yeah, and because you think that once your salary reaches a certain stage, Jane, that you don't claim for sandwiches and coffee.
At the same time as Archie Norman was appointed yesterday, Mark Boland was appointed as the chief exec of M&S.
Yes.
And he does have an astronomically high salary of something close to $4 million or something, but he has never, ever charged for any expenses because he believes he's paid enough to do his job.
Yeah.
Out of his own money. Now, I mean, the difference with these sort of...
Yeah, there's some middle ground there, isn't there? I mean, it's like, I'm thinking personally, I mean, I use my Oyster card for doing business trips, but I don't charge, you know, £1.50 every time I use my Oyster card.
No,
I mean, it's just ridiculous,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, well,
and poor old Andy Parfit.
Yes, this is...
I know.
I'm actually much more outraged about that amount of money than I'm about the 70p.
Explain the Andy Parfit.
Well, Andy Parfit, who gets a salary of $218,000 a year...
Still not bad.
Charged the corporation £541.83 for specialist clothing and equipment, which he bought before he climbed Mount Kilimanjaro for Comet Relief in March.
For charity.
I mean, this is basically North Face underwear, isn't it? This is
a big anorak and lots of thermal underwear. Yeah,
what I didn't understand, well, first of all, I didn't know that Andy Parfit had gone on that Kilimanjaro.
Well, presumably he went with Chris Moyle.
Well, I didn't know that at the time. Anyway, so he goes, it's a charity thing. You would have thought that he's probably an active chap. He might have some specialist clothing anyway.
Dreadful.
I mean, is it going to be returned?
Well, has it been returned to the BBC specialist clothing department? Yeah. So others who climb Camp Kilimanjaro next year can do the same thing. No, I mean, look, this is actually mean-spirited and really is embarrassing, you know. Mm. And when Caroline Thompson says, you know, it marks a step change in openness, simplicity and accountability, booyah.
Okay. Well, listen, the writer A.N. Wilson was on Any Questions on Radio 4 this week, and this is what he had to say about it.
Are we allowed to speak frankly about, although this is a BBC programme, about the director General.
You're allowed to speak as frankly. The fact that it's a BBC programme makes no difference so long as you're within the law. It's a platform for views.
I don't wish to seem distracted, but he's always seemed to me a little bit of a twit. And,
shall I give him the Any Answers number now so that he can ring in?
And I mean, every little crisis that's come his way, he's rather mishandled. He now seems to be grotesquely greedy to it. I mean, to receive something like 650,000, whatever it is, and then to claim a further 200,000 on it. Who can possibly need that amount of money? It's grotesque. I would happily become, if anybody would like me to be, the Director General of the BBC for one tenth of that man's salary.
Very good. That was Ian Wilson talking about Mark Thompson, obviously. Very funny. Let's just quickly whiz through a few other things. There's a digital economy bill coming out. Is that exciting, Jane?
It's been trailed a lot. You know, we sort of think this whole thing about illegal file sharing and... I mean, the big question is whether it's going to actually get through in time before a next election.
That'll be interesting. Media Week is going online only. Media Week's a funny old magazine, isn't it? It's really for, I think... despite its title, it's really for media buyers, isn't it? It's quite a specialist.
It's like when you look at sort of, you know, if you're Haymarket, you've got campaign, you've got marketing. It sort of fell between stalls, really, didn't it?
Yeah, I reckon. And finally, in our news and brief section, the radio player, much vaunted, has been revealed. This is quite interesting. All UK radio stations on one console.
Well, I sort of think the Tim Davey head of audio bit of the BBC, where he came in and immediately wanted to do this, the BBC linking up with commercial radio operators. It's been sort of a bit of an unsung story, because I do think it's actually really interesting. It's about sort of the BBC getting together with commercial operators without any sort of fuss, it seems.
Yeah,
and coming up with this thing that it could be, I mean, it's just been announced, could be really quite useful for consumers.
It's interesting, though, that they haven't been able to get away with it on TV, presumably because there's quite a lot of competition around.
Issues.
Yeah, but with radio, nobody else has been trying to do an aggregated radio player, so perhaps they will get away with it.
And also commercial radio gains from that. I mean, if the BBC is the front end, and commercial radio is bolted onto the BBC. Mm. Commercial radio actually benefits from that.
The slightly ironic thing, of course, is, as Jane said, Tim Davey has been playing the Mr. Unifier between the BBC and commercial radio. But as soon as he manages to get the top people at the BBC and commercial radio All singing from the same hymn sheet. The commercial radio starts falling out amongst itself.
Oh, commercial radio's gone into a mess again. It's unbelievable. Talk about self-destruction.
This is unbelievable. We've talked about that before. We shan't dwell on other people's pain. More links to all of these stories at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. And we'll finish with a bit more on the wireless. I interviewed Five Live controller Adrian Van Claveren this week for our friends over at the Radio Academy. Amongst the many topics discussed at our swanky central London location, we were talking at Allswang, the lawyers who have become a patron member of the Radio Academy, presumably because they want to get lots of business and do, because I think they were involved in the global radio, have been the Chrysalis deal, I think.
And you were in the Holborn office, were you?
Yes.
It's very swanky. Very nice.
Astonishing.
Yes.
The recession has not hit the
and there's Starbucks in reception.
There's a Starbucks in reception.
Yes. What more can you want?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously no free copies of the Times in that Starbucks.
I asked Adrian about
what else? His station's move to the northwest.
Five Live's a combination of news and of sport. Because of accidents of history, we're dotted all over Television Centre. You don't get a sense of a radio station you can walk into with Five Live. And actually what we will have in Salford is a building and a place that I think can really help us on that.
So if you want it to sound different, and sound less metropolitan, why are you taking all your roster of presenters with you?
Well, I think in terms of what you look at in terms of our presenters, we've got a pretty diverse group of presenters already in terms of where they come from, which parts of the country they come from, their backgrounds, how they sound, and so on. The important thing is to get the best possible sound for the station, wherever we're broadcasting from, and that's what we want to achieve. And you don't want to change things that don't need changing unless you've got a very good reason for doing so. So that's the reason on presenters. I think the sound comes from something much wider than just the presenters. They're an important part of it, but the sound also comes from what subjects you talk about, how you choose to talk about them, who the interviewees are, how that's put together, what judgments you make about what programmes you do. And those are actually the key things which I think, if you look at Five Live in 3 years' time, I think you'll be able to say that Five Live is actually demonstrably more different on many of those things than it is from the rest of the BBC News agenda than it is at the moment.
All right, we started to talk about presenters. I mean, of those who have committed, how many of them will travel up to Salford on a Sunday evening and back to London on a Friday afternoon?
Well, I think with presenters, I mean, each presenter's got to work out what works for them. From my point of view, the key thing is for the presenter to be there, to be able to present the programme in the way that Five Live needs it. That's the way it works at the moment, that's the way it will work in the future. Each presenter will work out their own solution to how they do that. What we've been very clear about is the station is moving to Salford. The programmes need to be presented from Salford, and that they have to commit to being able to do that.
Will you pay their train fares up and their hotel bills when they're there?
No, we will not.
I mean, the core of your output is the daily news and sport. You think you're going to be able to do that without maintaining without having your main base in the capital?
I'm certain that we can do that because
successfully.
I'm certain we can do that successfully because actually, what it is that we're trying to do is to tell all about news stories from right the way across the country, right the way around the world. You need a base to do it. But it doesn't need to be a particular base in West London or Central London in terms of how you do that. Actually, in terms of how technology now can deliver that material, you know, we can do so much now, so much more flexibly from wherever people are. It's just in the way that we can do OBs from many places, how we can draw in material in quality from many different places. All of those pluses are absolutely there. We have to be plugged into the BBC News machine. Of course we do. But there are lots of ways of doing that. BBC News is used to running kind of split-site operations, whether that's been Newsbeat in Yording House with Radio 1 separate from everything else, Bush House against Television Centre, all of those things, they're split site. And whether that split site is 5 miles away or 200 miles away, in a lot of ways, doesn't make a huge amount of difference. I mean, there will be down the lines, but actually there are quite a lot down the lines that either come from around England or indeed down the line to Millbank or down the line to Broadcasting House when we're in West London. There is quite a lot of that. It's looking at what the editorial reasons are for those, what the right way is of doing them, and when the right points are to do them. And I think we will do some, but we won't necessarily do every interview that way. We will be looking for other people we can interview, especially when you're looking for expertise or personal experience of a particular story. There's a lot of people there that you can get right the way across the north of England who we will be able to attract. It's also not the case to say that in terms of whether it's star names or politicians, you know, these people do actually visit the northwest of England. I know this sometimes comes as a shock to people, but they do. And that actually there will be quite a lot of opportunities to interview people in that way as well.
But and you're not going to not the same opportunities that there are in London and not the same opportunities for face-to-face interviews.
I think we have to be smart about how we book people and what we do. But you know, if you look at what's being built at Media City, you know, there's a television studio being built there which will be the biggest in the country. that is clearly predicated on attracting some pretty big productions to it, and with those big productions will go star names, for instance. So I think there is quite a lot there that you can do, and as long as we're smart about how we book people, you can get a lot from it.
Are you going, by the way?
Yes, I'm going, yes.
You're not retaining a house or base in London?
Well, retaining a house is a different thing from whether somebody is going, but I am going.
Excellent. Adrian Van Claveren there. You can hear the full, well, there's an hour of that Q&A on the Radio Academy's website. Follow the link from the Media Talk page. Paul, Adrian Van Claverclogs, he's very articulate. More articulate than some of his presenters, has to be said.
Very articulate, very fast speaking. I actually thought there's an honesty about what he said. Yeah. I thought he was pretty candid and obviously great interviewing, but, you know, he did actually tell it like it is, and, you know, he didn't try and fudge the thing. I mean, presenters will be coming back to London for the weekend, and he didn't say they weren't going to.
Yeah.
He was very clear, though, about hotels and travel, which I thought was very good.
Because that was a key question, isn't it?
Yes.
Nobody's been very clear about this yet, and he was very clear.
And look, if people do that at their own expense, absolutely fine, and you can say, well, that's okay. As long as they're there to present the programme and they're clearly living in Salford or Manchester area during the week, he's going to be happy with that. I think there was great clarity about that.
It's interesting, we were just chatting before we started recording this. You were doing a lot of interviews in Australia to launch Kids Co TV there, and you were saying that talk radio is a big thing there. And elsewhere in that interview, actually, with Adrian Van Claveren, he was saying that he thought that talk radio is very underdeveloped in Britain, and that Five Live can do more to develop it.
Yeah, I mean, I went on a number of different talk stations, both face-to-face and down the line in Australia, Brisbane, Adelaide, Sydney. And, you know, every town has got 2, 3, 4 of these stations. It's not just one. Mm. And there's really amazing hosts on there. Most of them are actually journalists. Most of them are actually, you know, quite seasoned. I mean, there was one guy, a guy called Colin Robertson, who I think he's been in the market 45 years, but he still sounds great. And he asks cheeky questions, but he really gets onto the community. There was another lady at a station in Brisbane who, in fact, is a housewife, and she literally drops the kids off at school, does her show during the day, and then she picks the kids up in the afternoon. And it wasn't as though it was full of radio technique, but it was a real authenticity about her. She's a real mum living in Australia, making it work, and she told it like it was.
And Five Live have, under Adrian Van Claveren, he has taken the station further away from being a light version of Radio 4, a more aggressive talk station anyway,
yeah,
hasn't
he? I mean, he's certainly made Radio 4 and Radio 5 Live much more differentiated.
Yes.
I think he's been helped by the fact that talk radio is now talk sport, so there wasn't a national forum for phone-in debate, and that's what Radio 5 Live is, and I think he's done it very well.
Hmm. And actually, Radio 4 are sort of trying to bring in much more of a, any questions, much more of a sort of talking,
yes,
type of area.
More built journalism, more built comedy, more panel shows.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's clear there's more. Well, as I said at the Radio Academy, it's not so much clear blue water, more quite a lot of red mist between Radio 4 and Radio 5 Live. Much more shouting on 5 Live. Now, listen, very quickly, before we go, I would like you to tell us, what have you learnt this week, Paul?
Well, I'm going to do a radio one, if I may, and that was, listened to Classic FM this week, who did this very strange listener day. If you know about this, rather than just sort of hearing the radio, the idea is you start listening to it. Now, Classic FM is sort of positioned as being, a relaxing station. Basically, it's very nice wallpaper, very good, very nice wallpaper. But they had Simon Bates describing details of the movement and who composed it and how it was arranged, and it felt really, really strange to me. Really strange. So my message really is, I think, stick to the knitting.
Yeah, all right. And Jane, why don't you give us a preview of Media Guardian on Monday. What have you got in store for us?
Well, we have an interview with Ben Bradshaw, sort of talking about the Digital Britain Bill, but also very keen to talk about Mr. Murdoch and the Tories.
Oh, right.
And sort of interesting that how he started off immediately going for the BBC and seems to have rowed back on that.
He definitely has.
It's as that with the Sun and with the sort of whole Tory agenda, they suddenly seem to have thought, oh, no, actually, we can say it's all them.
Yeah,
but
interesting.
Anyway.
Okay, great. So star interview with him.
Yeah, and stuff on the PCC. We've got lots of comments about the PCC.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's good.
Excellent. We look forward to Media Guardian on Monday. A quick word about next week's Media Talk. We'll be live in front of an audience of no doubt attractive and very intelligent 20-somethings, maybe a few teen-somethings as well, as part of the Guardian Student Media Conference. We're doing an edition of the show from that. I'll be there, obviously. So will Emily Bell, the Director of Digital Content at the Guardian. Also on the panel will be Five Live's Richard Bacon, Channel 4 News technology correspondent Ben Cohen, and all-round wunderkind student journalist Josh Halliday. All-star cast. Should be fun. For links to all our stories today, head to guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Find us on Facebook and on Twitter as well. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.